From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. There were surprises in Tuesday's primaries, with Bernie Sanders taking two of the three by more than 3-1, 80% in one, and Trump and Cruz splitting the pot with one each. Sanders took Utah and Idaho by more than 75% in each. Clinton took Arizona with 58%. Sanders gained a total of 57 delegates, now standing at 901. Clinton gained 51 delegates, now standing at 1214. Trump also won Arizona with 48% of the vote, while Ted Cruz took Utah with 69%. Trump scored 58 delegates for the day and Cruz 40. While the votes were being counted Tuesday evening, Bernie Sanders spoke to a packed house in San Diego.
When we began this campaign about 10 months ago, we were 3% in the polls, about 70 points behind Secretary Clinton. As of today, last poll that I saw, we are 5 points behind and we're gaining. When we began this campaign against the most powerful political organization in the country, we had no money and no volunteers. Now we have hundreds of thousands of volunteers all over this country. When we began this campaign, we were considered a fringe candidacy. Now who in America, the media said, could believe in a political revolution?
For more, we spoke with Professor Anthony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia Wednesday. Professor Montero, thank you for joining us this morning. It's a pleasure.
Yes, thank you very much. How are you doing, Don?
I'm doing well. So, an interesting night's returns in the three primaries. Sanders takes two out of three with overwhelming margins. In fact, 80% in one at the latest figures. Mm-hmm. Clinton takes Arizona, which... may be a little troubling. And then Trump and Cruz split. What's your take?
I think the Arizona results are going to be questioned, if not challenged, by the Sanders campaign. And it seems like a large number of voters were deprived of their right to vote, which seems like a classic form of machine politics suppressing voter turnout and access to voting places by the machine in Arizona. And if this happened, and if it can be proven, I think this is going to create a lot of anger and a lot of anti-Hillary Clinton, anti-Democratic Party machine going forward, which I think because it is the West has great implications for the race in California in June. We're in the middle of something very, very, very serious in terms of whether or not Bernie Sanders and his movement are being treated fairly. But of course, Arizona, and you know, like you said, Hillary Clinton is touting herself as the third term of the Obama administration. And of course, we know that with a smiling face, and of course, the so-called liberals and the Democratic Party elites always do it with a smiling face, Barack Obama has deported more people than any administration in recent history. Now, But the good news for the Sanders movement is the astounding victories in Idaho and in Utah, and the large, historically large turnouts in both of those caucus states. And as you know, the corporate media now has to admit, in totaling the numbers of delegates, it is unfair to include in the delegates won by votes of primary voters, to include among those the superdelegates. So at least the New York Times this morning is showing only the earned delegates. And what we see is a narrowing race as the Democratic primaries move to states where, you know, all of the experts that follow this stuff are now saying Sanders has big advantages. And one expert, in fact, the guy that called the 2008 election, and you know, your young guy set up this these statistical models and computerized them, which made him able to call, I think, 44 of the 50 states. Or even more in 2008, and he became Time Magazine's Man of the Year. He is predicting that Sanders will take all eight of the next eight primaries, which then, you know, narrows the gap. And what we're looking at is not just a contested Republican campaign, but maybe a contested Democratic Party campaign where the superdelegates are going to be in play, and people will probably be making the argument that the superdelegates will have to go with the way the majorities in their states went, or that a proportion of the superdelegates should or the superdelegates should be proportioned on the basis of the proportion of votes that each candidate got in the various states. So I think we're looking at a contested convention in Philadelphia when the Democrats come here. Now, on the Republican side, obviously in Utah, with the Mormon control of the Republican Party machine and Mitt Romney, you know, putting all of his political capital on the line to slow down Donald Trump.
Such as it is.
Yeah. Cruz got a big victory. But in the other primary, Arizona, which was the big one, I think, you know, things were the same as they've been throughout this primary season, and Donald Trump won.
So,
Going forward, just this last point, I think going forward, the sides are becoming angrier, and it's going to be a real intense affair in Cleveland among Republicans.
In Cleveland and Philly, it's going to be interesting. I mean, the count for between Clinton and Sanders now, outside of the superdelegates, so-called, the Times says today it's 1214 to 901, and that's before any real reevaluation of Arizona, which could swing ultimately, although who knows.
Absolutely.
And that comes after, basically up until yesterday, the previous primaries were in states that generally favor Clinton, and now they're going into some pretty big states like California, where Sanders is expected to run strong, and he may even surprise people and run very strong or win New York.
So you
get to the conventions where it's not decided. They end up getting brokered, and you maybe have exposed machine intervention in the process, voter games and everything by the Democratic Party machine. You already have the people behind Sanders not trusting that apparatus, and which is mirrored in the Republican Party. So what happens if we end up with two brokered conventions?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, But I think what we're looking at is an assault upon the political party establishments and the two-party duopoly itself by movements that have common positions on economic issues, but not necessarily the same solutions, but at the same time, the same socioeconomic groups are more or less in these two movements, that is the Trump and Sanders movements. I think what we are seeing is the delegitimation of the elites of both parties and probably of both parties themselves, and the rise of what we, you know, some years ago used to call movement politics, where movements are primary over political establishments and political elites and bureaucrats and so on. I think that now the Sanders movement is not only interested in delegitimating the Democratic Party elite and the Clintons, but I think in bringing the whole thing down, as is the case with the Donald Trump movement. It is not just a movement to delegitimate or even to just to win a nomination, but to really bring the whole thing down. I think we're in a new era, both ideologically and politically, and the landscape is being radically remade as we speak. And therefore, the future in terms of specifics is very difficult to predict. I think, however, and you're right about this, Don, we might have two brokered conventions. Trump predicted riots in Cleveland, and we might have and I've used his words, riots in Philadelphia, if the Sanders people come here and feel that they have been robbed.
You know, the movements behind each of those two candidates, Trump and Sanders, happen in the American landscape, which is, first of all, riddled with racism and all kinds of xenophobia. You've got the issue of immigrants that's very big in that, and there's an ideological divide on that issue. Mm-hmm. And, people are hurling the word fascist around at Trump in particular. I haven't heard it like that since Nixon. And yet, the policies, if you look at the policies that have been spoken by the various candidates, certainly the term fascism could be applied to many of them, and perhaps not Trump by any means. Now, assuming that the caricature of Germany just and the rise of Hitler that's being bandied about here were to be examined, the condition that differs here in the United States and the prospects for a white supremacist-type fascism that people are trying to impute to Trump and that movement would be occurring in a society that is almost already majority non-white. So maybe you could parse some of this stuff for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked about this before on your show, Don, and I, I'm constantly saying if Trump is a fascist, then what does that make Hillary Clinton? You know, the transcript of, I think, last week's interview and discussion between the editorial board of The Washington Post and Donald Trump is, I think, still online. I read it yesterday.
And thank you for sending it to me, too, because I read it after you sent it to me, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It is very revealing. I mean, now, Trump is not a warm and fuzzy liberal. In fact, there is some indication that on a number of issues, he's in over his head with this talk of deporting people, of torture, and all of this type of thing. But then when you listen to him speak, and it's interesting, Thomas Frank, who wrote the book back in the 90s, the famous political analysis of whites cross white Democrats and working class Democrats crossing over to become Reagan Democrats, the book entitled What Happened in Kansas, he had a very important article in The Guardian, the London Guardian. And what he discovered after studying Trump's speeches, he said he talks more about trade and jobs than any other issue. That these other things seem to be peripheral to his major concern about the export of jobs, unemployment, the loss of income, and really the redistribution of wealth upward. Now, if you read this very long transcript of his discussion with the Washington Post editorial board, the whole thing centers around jobs, African-American youth unemployment, creating jobs, protecting jobs of the American working class. He excoriates Carrier and Nabisco and Ford for exporting jobs overseas. He also says, and this is almost a quote, he says, in Iraq, we can build a school. The school will be destroyed. We'll build it a second time. That will be destroyed, and we'll build it a third time. And he said, over this time, we say we don't have enough money to build schools here in the United States. And he says, in particular, in what he calls the inner city, the African-American poor communities. Then he goes on to challenge all of the military spending on these adventures overseas, including the Ukraine, our tremendous and disproportionate spending upon NATO, and these other foreign interventions. And then he includes in, you know, all of this misappropriated or misspent money on the military, he includes corruption and waste in military spending on weapons that don't work right here at home. And he implies that that money has to be, we have to make savings, and that money has to be transferred to, as he puts it, make the country great again.
He spent
The guy that you hear in these speeches, the guy that Thomas Frank discovered by listening to his speeches, the guy that comes across in the Washington Post interview is not the, and I put quotes, not the fascist that is being demonized in the corporate media.
You know, he spends a decent amount of time also talking about building infrastructure, and China has been building infrastructure, and we have been wasting money on the military, basically. What's interesting is that this is a guy who comes out of the construction industry. Presumably the interests behind him that have used his name and stuff in all these major construction projects and the ones he built himself, you know, those are all folks that have this tremendous capacity to produce things that have been sitting idly. And there's this huge need for construction here. So is it possible that we're seeing some kind of a, you know, internecine struggle among the bourgeoisie from people who have been feeding the military all this time to finally say, hey, we need some of this ourselves?
I think that's true. I think that's very true, including you know, when you talk about an internal struggle within the bourgeoisie, I mean, we're talking about also small and medium-sized construction business and suppliers and others who would be involved in rebuilding the U.S. infrastructure. And, you know, because the money would come from the government, it would kind of shut out a lot of these big banks like, you know, Wells Fargo and Goldman Sachs and Citibank. and so on and so forth. You know, this is a profound development. You know, like the Economist Intelligence Unit recently came out with a report where they consider Donald Trump more dangerous than Islamic terrorism. And the reason they feel he is the most dangerous is because of his position on trade and protecting the U.S. economy, the U.S. real economy, and U.S. jobs.
If that's the case, and you're right, you mentioned this whole group of people who are now, you know, impoverished middle class. Carpenters, plumbers, guy who owns the local lumber yard, and also some of the bourgeoisie, say whoever it is that owns the large chains that deliver construction supplies, like Home Depot, that all of those would benefit from a resurgence of construction activity and particularly government-funded infrastructure development.
Yes. I think you're absolutely right. The implications and consequences of this are also very huge. I think we have to begin thinking in those terms so that we get an accurate and scientific picture of what's going on rather than following the corporate media's line on what's going on. I think the left has to begin to think for itself. And at this point, it's not thinking clearly enough for itself on these matters.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's being sold, at least in subtext, and in some places, if you read some of the alleged socialist websites, is that Hillary Clinton is the united front candidate against Trump Hitler.
Yeah, right. And when did Hillary Clinton become an anti-fascist? Or when did Ted Cruz become a leading figure in a popular front against fascism? You know, it's laughable.
So suppose we're looking at dissension inside the bourgeoisie. You have these two formations of workers and, some considerable division between them, particularly over issues of race and somewhat of class. I would suspect that the middle class is more heavily represented, the impoverished middle class more heavily represented in behind Trump than behind Sanders, but not exclusively. So you have those contradictions, and suppose we end up with Sanders and Trump, both of them hostile to Wall Street on some very fundamental issues, and what kind of a campaign would that be with these two competing mass movements behind them, and then what could happen in the aftermath, just speculating a little?
Well, you're talking about the best of all possible worlds for the working class. The working class would be able to politically breathe in ways that it has not in over 40 years. It would be the worst of all possible worlds for the 1%. That's their worst nightmare. That would allow the left behind a Bernie Sanders candidacy to genuinely take on all of the issues of rebuilding the real economy, bringing the military-industrial and the police state under control, if not bringing it down, all of these issues of foreign policy, including the Israeli-Palestinian question. Without a Sanders candidacy and with Trump as the Republican candidate, Trump runs to the left of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. I mean, what happens? Does this united front cede the high ground on foreign policy to Trump?
well, he would be the non-interventionist,
right,
or the more non-interventionist, and he would be the one who is talking about cutting back on military spending and, you know, transferring a lot of those funds to rebuilding the infrastructure and schools. And as he said in that Washington Post interview, you know, he said the unemployment among black youth is horrific and something has to be done. It's an emergency. And he implied that if something is not done, we are looking at a summer of terrible riots.
Yeah, he said worse than last time. And
As far as
the military goes, he also said that it's insane for us to be building nuclear weapons. He sounded like he wanted to get rid of them, but he certainly doesn't want to do the modernization that President Obama does. And he wants to make peace with Russia and China.
I mean, he doesn't sound like a fascist to me. Now, he sounds like a crazy person on a number of questions, and it might be his way of trying to, you know, cobble together some kind of center-right alliance. When you look more deeply, especially when it comes to war and peace, and preventing nuclear war and stopping all of these interventions, Trump almost sounds like a peace candidate.
Right. And so if that happens, then you have Trump saying these things. Sanders has to either take the same identical position so that now it's about economic policy, or a different one, which would mean either going further to the left on these things or moving further to the right.
Right. And I think, given the fact that Bernie didn't go to the AIPAC conference and that his speech came out against the settlements and called for a two-state solution, and in terms of national politics seemed to be more pro-Palestinian than we have heard in decades.
Finally, let's say instead it is Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. So Hillary Clinton can be expected, as the third term of Barack Obama, to want to continue, for example, nuclear weapons modernization. And we've already heard from her on Syria and a whole bunch of other places. How does that play in a country that polling repeatedly shows has a majority of the population against that kind of intervention?
Right. Well, I think if we have a Trump-Clinton race in the fall, I think the left is going to have to look at both of these candidates, the substance of their platforms. We're going to have to look at the looming issues of war and peace, of rebuilding the real economy in this country. And I hate to use this language, have to decide upon not just the lesser of evils, but almost isolating the greatest threat to the human race that currently exists, and that would be a Clinton presidency. I think the Clinton presidency, and we don't need to speculate. I mean, we have enough evidence. Takes us down the road to war, nuclear buildup, confrontation with Russia, confrontation with China, more of these disastrous trade pacts that impoverish and immiserate the American people, and so on and so forth. I think it is now becoming clear, Don, that the greatest threat to the American people and to the world's people in this upcoming election is Hillary Clinton, not Donald Trump.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.